Hello and welcome. I am Beth McGinn. I'm joined today by two of my partners at Buckley Sandler, Jeff Naiman and Ben Saul. We represent banks and other financial institutions in class action and complex civil litigation, government investigations, and regulatory matters. Today, we are going to discuss litigation and enforcement developments that have followed in the wake of the Supreme Court's Walmart versus Dukes decision, including how the Dukes decision is influencing the defense of class actions and fair lending lawsuits. First, I'd like to provide some brief background on the Dukes case. In 2001, a group of current and former female Walmart employees filed a class action against Walmart. They claimed that Walmart discriminated against them by withholding equal pay and earned promotions in violation of Title VII of the Civil Rights Act of 1964. The proposed plaintiff class would have numbered 1.5 million women, which would have made it the largest plaintiff class ever in an American court. The plaintiff's theory was that Walmart's explicit policy of giving local managers wide discretion in promotions and pay, coupled with a culture of male-dominated leadership that was vulnerable to gender bias, and statistics which purported to show disparities in pay and promotion for female employees across the company, was sufficient to create a class action under Federal Rule of Civil Procedure 23b2. The Federal District Court approved the certification motion, which was largely affirmed by the Ninth Circuit in a divided en banc opinion. The Supreme Court heard Walmart's appeal last term and then issued its decision on June 20th of this year. In a 5-4 opinion, the Supreme Court held that the plaintiffs failed to meet the commonality standard required by Federal Rule of Civil Procedure 23A2 and that the certification motion should have been denied. Furthermore, the entire court held that the plaintiffs' back pay claims could not be certified under Rule 23B2. I would like to begin with a general discussion of what the Dukes commonality holding will likely mean for class actions generally. Ben, can you provide us with that backdrop?
Sure, Beth. Before Dukes, a number of circuit courts, within their overall class certification analysis, had set a relatively low bar for plaintiffs to clear in order to satisfy the Rule 23A commonality requirement. And in most class cases, the question of commonality of the claims brought by the putative plaintiff class wasn't a very significant one. After Dukes, however, plaintiffs now must provide significant proof that there's a critical factual nexus among all of the plaintiff's class claims. In a discrimination case, the Supreme Court has now made clear that for putative class plaintiffs to satisfy this enhanced commonality standard, each member of the potential class must produce a common answer to the crucial question of why was I disfavored.
Jeff, you represent several banks in state and federal regulatory matters relating to fair lending. I want to discuss broadly how Dukes will impact lending discrimination claims. But as a first step, can you discuss how this affects the view of individual discretion?
Sure, Beth. In Dukes, the court explicitly stated that granting individual managers the discretion to make reasonable business judgments about pay and promotion is, and I quote, a very common and presumptively reasonable way of doing business, close quote. This seems to reflect the court's view that, at a minimum, it is reasonable for corporations to trust the professional decisions of managers and employees to follow company policies against discrimination in their exercise of judgment, and that courts should not assume that such expertise and such discretion is being exercised in a discriminatory manner. It is telling that, even facing the risk of discrimination cases over the years, and those have been many, companies have maintained numerous policies that involve employees exercising discretion because the elimination of discretion in judgment is overly rigid and ineffective. You know, it's kind of like those customer service calls where the customer service agent is always required to extend the call by asking, is there anything else I can do for you? Even if you have told the agent several times that you are in a rush to be off the phone. It's that kind of rigid requirement that removes human judgment leads to worse customer service.
Jeff, I really didn't expect to be discussing voice jail on this podcast. Dukes is an employment case. You seem to expect that it will extend to banks and lending operations. Do you think enforcement officials, regulators, and plaintiff's lawyers will reject extending its application to lending?
Although Dukes is a Title VII employment discrimination case, it looks like it will, in fact, cast a broad shadow over all of discrimination law and will be extended, as of many prior doctrines developed in the employment context, to other anti-discrimination statutes governing other aspects of life, such as lending and housing. In lending, if these officials make too big of a stink about extending an employment case to lending discrimination, they may find they will be undercutting the premise on which they've asserted that disparate impact applies at all under the Equal Credit Opportunity Act and the Fair Housing Act. I think the harder issue, and one I hope you and Ben will address later, is how Dukes, which is about a procedural standard in certifying a class, may be extended as a substantive holding in discrimination law. In terms of how this will be implemented in the current regulatory quagmire, I guess we have to expect that the regulators and enforcement officials, especially ones that disagree with this decision, to resist this change. In some cases, those officials will be in a position to impose a settlement in a way that will not risk review by a federal court, especially in the context of bank examination. However, we're going to see banks and other lenders push back on the basis that it is now clear that certain enforcement positions can no longer be supported by law. At least at the outset, it is the degree of this pushback that will help to define the parameters of how Dukes impinges on bank operations. Now, moving this from the realm of employment to the realm of consumer lending, lenders have traditionally given both pricing and underwriting discretion to a variety of types of employees or third parties such as brokers. Almost every lender will have policies prohibiting lending discrimination and training aimed at ensuring that employees understand that policy. It'll be very difficult to bring a disparate impact case on the basis of a policy of discretion. If you'll give me one more moment, I think it needs to be stated that this does not give lenders any leeway to discriminate. Remember, the use of disparate impact analysis against the use of discretion in lending and pricing decisions was really meant to short-circuit the harder work for plaintiffs of showing that discretion was being used in a discriminatory manner. And the bank regulators have kind of helped that theory along by developing an ingrained assumption that any differences that the lender could not demonstrate related to, you know, directly to credit quality must be discriminatory. This assumption has caused lenders and legal departments to work to remove discretion in an attempt to preemptively reduce the risk that private parties or regulators will bring a fair lending challenge.
Jeff, I think it's important to take you up on your earlier invitation to discuss why this Rule 23 commonality holding extends beyond all class actions and the procedures governing those cases to all disparate impact litigation. The analysis requires two steps. First, in resolving the Rule 23 issues, the Supreme Court followed a very long line of cases that make clear that it's entirely appropriate to assess the merits of the claim in conjunction with the commonality inquiry. The basic premise has existed for three decades, but it's caused some confusion among judges and practitioners and has finally been articulated by the court as follows, and this is a quote, "Proof of commonality necessarily overlaps with respondents' merits contention. As a result, even though Dukes is framed as a class case, the court, by its own words, has recognized that its decision required it to assess and opine on the merits of the Dukes case itself, that is, on the underlying substance of the putative class plaintiff's disparate impact discrimination claims. It is largely the merits portion of the court's opinion that will inform discrimination law going forward."
And Ben, in these few months since the decision came down, how has Dukes been applied involving financial services companies in fair lending and other similar cases?
It's been fascinating how quickly the case is changing the litigation landscape. And I think the speed in which the decision has taken root strongly suggests it will continue to heavily influence how courts handle fair lending class actions. For example, in a lending discrimination case brought against Wells Fargo, a federal district court in California recently issued an opinion relying almost entirely on the Dukes case to deny the plaintiff's petition for class certification. In that case, the punitive class plaintiffs alleged that Wells Fargo's policy of giving its loan officers and mortgage lenders a small range of discretion in setting fees, yield spread premiums, and interest rates caused discrimination against minority borrowers. The Wells case shares several similarities with the Dukes case: a major nationwide company, a policy of discretion for employees, a written policy clearly prohibiting discrimination, several factors that lead to individual decisions, even a statistical model proposed by the plaintiffs in support of class certification. And, like in Dukes, the trial court held in Wells that the class could not be certified because the number of different factors meant that there was no, quote-unquote, common mode of discrimination that would unite all of these different claims of discrimination. The analysis of the Wells trial court has already been echoed in a virtually identical order entered in a multi-district mortgage lending case in the Western District of Kentucky. Although Dukes is a recent decision, these two orders indicate that courts are applying Dukes consistently in the context of mortgage lending discrimination.
Ben, although Dukes seems to be a very defendant-friendly class action decision, are there any parts of this decision that could cause problems for defendants?
Absolutely. Dukes does sound some notes of caution for defendants, principally those looking to use the class vehicle as a means to settle multiple potential claims at once. Dukes makes this harder in two ways. First, because all class action settlements must be court approved to safeguard against harm to absent class members, Dukes's heightened Rule 23A commonality requirement, like traditional petitions for class certification, will make it harder to obtain such approval for certain class settlements. For example, in Rodriguez versus National City Bank, a federal district court in Pennsylvania rejected a proposed fair lending class settlement. Rodriguez, much like the Wells Fargo case, also involved individual loan officer discretion and allegations of discriminatory pricing. As with Wells Fargo, the court held that the class action could not survive because of the lack of commonality in the class action. However, the parties in Rodriguez were in settlement negotiations and had submitted a proposed settlement that would resolve claims for over 153,000 individuals. The court rejected the parties' settlement in light of the strengthened commonality requirement in Dukes. The Rodriguez decision is only a few weeks old, but it's unclear if the plaintiffs will attempt to reform and refile their putative class, or if they'll abandon the case entirely. The stricter commonality requirement is not the only change to Rule 23 that will impinge upon defendants' ability to use the class vehicle to achieve settlements that they perceive are advantageous. The Dukes Court also scaled back the ability to use Rule 23b2, which does not allow for class members to opt out of the class and which is meant to cover largely injunctive and declaratory relief as a means to resolve certain monetary claims. Ultimately, the combination of the court's Rule 23A and B2 pronouncements will limit the availability of the class action settlement as a means to resolve certain claims. As a result, and especially in the B2 context, that could have real impact for defendants who, for whatever reason, prefer consensual resolution in a given matter.
Jeff, it seems like Dukes gives defendants a sweeping tool with which to avoid class actions. Under what circumstances do you think class action would survive the Dukes test?
Well, there are two other recent cases that illustrate an explicit company policy approach to class certification. Plaintiffs filed a federal class action in Iowa claiming that Tyson Foods violated the law by not paying employees for certain activities. Because the challenge was to a standard company-wide policy of not paying employees, rather than a challenge based purely on individualized discretion, the court held that this case was distinguishable from Dukes and the class action could proceed. In another case, in Churchill versus Cigna, the plaintiffs were customers of Cigna Insurance who challenged the denial of coverage for a specific behavioral treatment for autism. Here, all of the putative class members sought the same treatment for their autism, and all the class members were denied insurance coverage under Cigna's national policy. Because the treatment was the same, and all the denials were based upon the same clear nationwide policy of denying reimbursement for that claim, a court held that this class action survived the narrow definition of commonality articulated in Dukes. An analogous practice in lending would be a neutral underwriting criterion applied to all applicants equally, but having an alleged disparate impact on minority applicants. In fact, we represent a bank right now that has been referred on a disparate impact theory for the use of a highly predictive neutral underwriting criterion.
Jeff, let me build on your analysis by discussing a case involving a more pure consumer finance issue. That case, captioned AHO versus AmeriCredit Financial Services, was decided by the Ninth Circuit and held that a broad class certification survived the Dukes test. In AHO, the plaintiff took out a retail installment sales contract for the purchase of a truck and then defaulted on his payments. After defendant AmeriCredit sent a notice of intent to repossess and sell the truck to AHO, he filed suit. Plaintiff's claim was that the notice of intent failed to list all of the conditions required for plaintiff to reinstate his loan in violation of California's Fair Debt Collection Practices Act and unfair competition law. Plaintiff also sought to certify a class of all vehicle owners who had their property seized and sold by AmeriCredit. The court analyzed the plaintiff's alleged harm under the Dukes rubric and nevertheless decided to certify the proposed class on the ground that class-wide litigation would produce common answers to common questions. The court's analysis was based on the following findings. First, defendants used only one form of notice. Second, that the same California law applied to all claims of the members of the putative class. And third, the effect of the allegations were the same for all members. To put these company policy cases in context, I'd like to also briefly mention another post-Dukes case involving a company policy issue, which was decided in California and in which class certification was rejected, the consolidated countrywide mortgage marketing litigation. In that case, the plaintiffs attempted to gain class certification for RICO and state law fraud claims by showing that the defendants had a uniform sales pitch and policy to offer high-cost loans to borrowers. Applying Dukes, the district court rejected class certification and held that the limited elements of commonality only applied to a portion of the putative class population. Specifically, the court held that the common policy only affected one of the four sets of loans, and even then, for certain borrowers, those loans would not be unfair, and the individual questions predominated over the common ones. This shows that the quote-unquote company policy class certification theory requires plaintiffs to prove that the policy was truly applied to all class members.
Moving away from the commonality requirements set forth in Dukes for a bit, Ben, you mentioned earlier that if a case can satisfy Rule 23A's commonality requirement, Dukes imposed a higher burden for plaintiffs seeking to certify claims of individualized monetary relief under Rule 23B2. As the court described it, the key to B2 class certification is the indivisible nature of the injunctive or declaratory remedy warranted, the notion that the conduct is such that it can be enjoined or declared unlawful only as to all of the class members or as to none of them. As a result, the B2 analysis is not about balancing the predominance of the monetary relief. This marks a sharp departure from the test previously used by lower courts. Thus, going forward, if the injunction or declaratory relief traditionally sought under 23B2 is indivisible and affects all class members the same way, any monetary damages sought under the rule must be similarly indivisible.
Beth, that's just right. In fact, in the Aho case that I was just mentioning, the point is really illustrated. In Aho, the court divided the vehicle owners into two different subclasses. The first subclass included only borrowers who'd be entitled to a flat statutory damages amount under California law of $1,000. Because the statutory damages would benefit the entire class equally and accrue automatically as a function of the subclass's claim, the court held that these damages survived under Rule 23B2. As for the second subclass, it would receive the relevant statutory damages plus certain additional damages for improper fees that the subclass members might have paid. The court allowed the second subclass to proceed as well on the theory that the legal argument for restitution was identical in every instance and that the only difference was the amount of the restitution, a fact that could easily be determined from the defendant's business records.
Ben and Jeff, another development I find noteworthy is that even in non-class cases, we're hearing echoes of Dukes and its requirement that individualized determinations of damages occur in discretion-based claims. For example, in one recent fair lending matter, though it did not cite Dukes, I'm aware of the trial court judge using reasoning strongly in line with the Supreme Court's Dukes to hold that discovery in that case, which is proceeding on a disparate impact theory, must be limited to individualized harms. Another interesting issue is whether Dukes and its progeny will have any effect on state court class actions and determinations of damages. Ben and Jeff, what are your thoughts on this?
If I could field that one, I think the answer is possibly. First, although Dukes doesn't bind state courts, it'll nevertheless be persuasive to many of them, especially in jurisdictions where the state rules of civil procedure for class actions mirror the federal rules. For example, in two of those jurisdictions, Florida and Michigan, courts have already cited Dukes and its quote-unquote far-reaching implications for certification of class action lawsuits and have elected to analyze commonality with an eye towards Dukes. Second, although the Dukes court never reached the issue, in considering the limits of Rule 23b2 of whether claims for monetary relief under that provision violated the Due Process Clause because such claims would deprive Walmart of the ability to defend against each individual's monetary claim, the court noted in dicta the serious possibility that recovery of monetary damages under 23b2 could violate due process, even when monetary claims don't predominate, given the lack of notice and opt-out provisions for B2 classes. If the court were to squarely address the due process issue, that could have a major impact on class actions in state court. Alternatively, the Walmart briefing provides a roadmap for defendants who might be interested in advancing that argument in state courts where it might get more traction.
Jeff, given the divergent acceptance of Dukes among the lower courts, what do you think we should take away from all of this?
That's an interesting question, Beth. First and most importantly, in determining if there is a, quote, common mode, close quote, connecting all of the plaintiffs, so that we really need some substantial commonality, litigants in courts should look closely at the factual theory of the complaint and how it relates to the putative class members. As we are seeing, class certification will succeed or fail under Dukes based upon the theory of the case that the plaintiffs set forth. The more that plaintiffs can show common actions without discretion, be it through a common policy, a common set of standard forms, or another method, the more likely that class certification will survive a challenge under Dukes. The Aho, Tyson, and Churchill cases all show that when class action theory is based on exactly identical circumstances with no possibility of deviation, class certification is still possible under Dukes. Conversely, when individuals have discretion and the alleged harm comes from the exercise of human discretion over hundreds or thousands of different interactions, framing a class action complaint is now much harder. And even if there is a company policy and limited discretion, as there was in the Countrywide case, class certification is not guaranteed absent a showing that the policy truly affects the entire class.
Ben, given the impact of Dukes, what trends do you think we will see in the framing of complaints or the forms selected for cases moving forward?
I don't think it's any stretch to state that we'll likely see fewer class actions filed and fewer certified in the next few years as plaintiffs and courts alike seek to incorporate Dukes into their understanding of Rule 23, but I think we will see a different distribution of class actions, with more being filed in state courts where Dukes is not directly binding. I also think we'll generally see plaintiffs seek to certify smaller classes as a means to maximize the chance of surviving the class certification stage, given the Dukes decision. For example, lead counsel for the Dukes plaintiffs has already stated that he intends to take the same theory for his case, but form smaller classes on the regional, state, and even store-by-store level and proceed. A rise in state-filed class actions will certainly have its limits, given the Class Action Fairness Act, which, among other things, sets a removal threshold of $5 million in damages. Separately, over the long term, there's an outside possibility that Dukes will lead to an increased rather than a decreased set of litigation costs for class action defendants as they grapple with several smaller class actions posing essentially the same question or set of questions rather than a single class action that can be handled in a consolidated, efficient manner. Conversely, we may see more so-called mass action litigation where plaintiffs' counsel attempts to sign up a large number of potential plaintiffs and avoid the strictures of class action.
If I can jump in, I think that in addition to the procedural and tactical moves that Ben just mentioned, we will see more defense counsel raise the argument that any recovery of monetary damages under Rule 23b2 violates due process. The court has indicated that it may be receptive to this argument, so we will likely see it tried out in lower court federal litigation in coming years. As a due process question, this is also one of the few arguments from Dukes that can be directly imported to state court class action defense.
Ben, how will Dukes affect the standard of proof for class certification?
Although the court did not directly issue a holding on the use of expert testimony at class certification, the majority did say that it doubted that expert testimony at the class certification stage was exempted from the requirements of Daubert, and the court's reasoning here is intuitive. There's nothing in the text of Daubert or the logic of that opinion to indicate that class certification, a major defining moment in the pursuit of an action, should be exempted from Daubert's basic threshold analysis. It stands to reason that if evidence is inadmissible at trial because it doesn't meet the Daubert test, it should be similarly inadmissible at the class certification stage. Combined with the other holdings in Dukes, this will generally make it harder for plaintiff's counsel to certify a class action, especially if the class action is predicated upon a complicated disparate impact theory requiring expert analysis of a corporate culture, patterns of decisions, or other complex data to establish commonality.
Jeff, do you think that Dukes will reframe the regulator's approach to disparate impact claims?
Well, as I noted earlier, I think there may be some resistance from regulators. One other piece here is the court's rejection of sampling and formulas in assessing damages. In fair lending exams and enforcement actions, regulators and the DOJ often try to determine the amount of damages by using easily available financial metrics, differences in interest rates compounded over time, the amount of yield spread premiums, and the like. And they use those to calculate harm to, you know, what they view as the harm to the borrowers. Dukes implies that a defendant in a disparate impact lending case has the right to raise all of the non-quantitative reasons why lending decisions may be different for different borrowers. Such intangible but, you know, in fact, critically important factors can include local market conditions and local market competition in facing that, you know, that borrower, that the borrower level of sophistication, borrower price negotiation. So all of those things that lenders have been, you know, arguing about in the past and have been largely ignored by DOJ and the regulators, I think, are kind of strengthened by the Dukes case. In addition, you know, the financial regulatory investigations, which are, they address thousands and sometimes even millions of accounts and customers, up till now, they've tried to use formulas and other kinds of mathematical analysis to simplify the enforcement task. And, you know, in that they've been, I guess, a limited success, depending on your perspective. However, in the post-Dukes world, lenders will press regulators to justify their use of statistics and math to substitute for individualized analyses of harm. And that's going to make it very, you know, that's going to, you know, put a very high burden on the enforcement actors, like the regulators, in doing so. What I think we will see, just as in the AHO case, is that such computations will be used when the alleged harm to consumers comes through a truly uniform action by the defendant, or uniform actions, really, rather than those involving discretion. Of course, it could also cut the other way. Knowing that defending a trial by formula in court will be difficult, we may see the government work through more regulatory actions and consent orders rather than enforcement actions that end up in federal or state court. Without the close judicial scrutiny that's now going to be required in class action litigation, the regulatory option may be the only way that federal regulators can continue to bring actions of the size and scope that they are used to doing.
Thank you for listening to our podcast. If you have any questions about Dukes and its impact on class action litigation, disparate impact claims, and regulatory enforcement, please feel free to contact any of us at 202-349-8000.